So, yesterday I was introducing a topic, which is consciousness unfolds, a broad topic that I can say more or less anything about. And I'm trying to explore this very mysterious, indefinable dimension of our lives. You can hardly call it a dimension of our lives, the very basis of our lives, which is awareness. I was trying to bring to our attention the way in which, first of all, we get from time to time, quite spontaneously, quite naturally, experiences of awareness just, as it were, pure, raw, unformed, undefined, not located. It just dawns from time to time. And I described a few of my own experiences going back to my first memory, indeed, and of course including my drug memories, such as they are. And ones that emerge in quite ordinary situations of sickness or something like that, or even just waking up in the morning. Suddenly there's just awareness, very little structure to it, very little specific content to it. And I wanted to recount those experiences because I'm sure they're not ones that are uncommon. I'm sure everybody will have had something of that kind at some point in their life. The middle of the night experience. Do you get that? Yeah, quite often. Just wake up in the middle of the night, not able to sleep, but quite contented, and my mind is completely open without any real content. And of course, this also happens in meditation, which is where it's supposed to happen. But these sort of experiences are part of life. They're not Buddhist experiences, if you see what I mean. It's just that Buddhism gives a particular approach and focus to them. So this is really the starting point. Something that we all have some access to, I'm quite convinced. And that even if we don't experience it in such dramatic forms as even I recounted yesterday, which is not particularly dramatic, it's nonetheless at the background of every moment of our lives is simply the act of awareness. Otherwise, there's no moment, there's no life. Without awareness, there's no life. All the time, we're aware. It just unfolds again and again and again. And I explored the fact that one of the most fascinating things about awareness is that, or about consciousness, is that it doesn't belong in any of the categories that we can usually think through, if you see what I mean. Our language, our conceptualization is built up on objectification. We objectify things, we turn them into objects so that we can think about them. You can't turn consciousness into an object. As soon as you turn it into an object, you falsify it. Actually, that's true of everything, but that's in a much more dramatic and major way. Consciousness is not capable of objectification because it's what does the objectifying. It's what things become come into awareness within. And the language gets really strange. I found myself getting a bit spooked as I was speaking yesterday because I'm aware all the time that I'm using language in a way that is completely inadequate to what I'm talking about. As soon as you start to talk about consciousness, you're using a metaphor that really doesn't do for what it is that you're trying to talk about. And I was suggesting that reflecting on this, really connecting with the fact that consciousness is an indefinable background. Look, hear me then. What nonsense background. What else can you do, though? If you're going to say anything, if you dare to give a series of talks on consciousness unfolds, you're kind of condemned to language and condemned, therefore, to not talking about the very thing that you've made your title or talking about in such elliptical ways that you get confused. I don't know about the audience. We're condemned to to talk about it, because we need to learn how to do it better, if you like. But in talking about it, we falsify it. So if we can recognize that that is inevitable, that every thought we have about consciousness misses consciousness, we get closer to what it is. It's Heidegger's moving round a topic. You get round and round and round it, and you seem to be approaching the centre, but the object that you're circling round never appears. Consciousness can never be objectified. And that is a key practice, in a way, reflecting on the non-objectifiability of consciousness. So, I then discussed the way in which where consciousness fits into the spectrum of experience, and I discussed it. God, you see, all these metaphors. As soon as I say spectrum, you've got a picture of a row of colours, as it were, as if consciousness is one colour. It's red rather than green, blue, yellow, or whatever. It's not like that at all. But you've got to talk. I've got to. I'm a compulsive talker. Where does it fit into the experiential situation? Those of you here for the meditation will have got some idea of what I'm talking about. I went through a reflection on elements of our experience in terms of the famous five skandhas. Skanda is a Sanskrit word, usually translated as heap. It really just means category. The way I put it is it's a drawer in a five-drawered filing cabinet. So we've got a five-drawered filing cabinet, and everything in this situation, according to the Buddha's teaching, can be fitted into one or other of those drawers. Experience itself is undifferentiated. It just flows. But we, in thinking about it, break it up into these five categories, these five heaps. This goes there, that goes there, that goes there, and so on. So I'm going to go into this a little bit more fully today. I went into it very briefly yesterday, and I saw the look of benumbment on people's faces. So I'll take it a little bit more slowly, and hopefully intelligence will dawn in your faces. It weren't too bad. So I'll tell you them in Sanskrit, just because you'll often hear them referred to in those ways, but I'll tell you what they mean as well. So the five skandhas, they're spelled like this. Skanda. Skanda is a plural. D rather than D. So the first is rupa. Second is vedana. Next, samnya. Samskara. An H, yes, samskara. And vijnana. So, rupa is usually translated as form. But that's really quite an inadequate translation. It's probably better to translate it something more like image, or even, for the Schopenhauerians amongst you, representation. It's the sensory images that present themselves to you. So the sights, that is the colours, the shapes, the intensities of light that present themselves to you, that the sounds that impact on your auditory mechanism, organism, the smells, the tastes, and the touches. But it also includes the images that present themselves to your mind. By image, I don't mean merely visual, by the way. I mean the object of the senses. Not in the sense of the object, as it were, out there, but the object that you create, that your sensory mechanism and your nervous system cooks up for you, so to speak. You know, what I'm seeing is not you, but the image that my mind creates from the data that it receives, through the eye and so forth, of you. That is rupa. It's the constructed image that the sensory mechanism presents to me. Here, Buddhism is, in a way you could say, strictly phenomenological. It remains agnostic, in a certain sense, about what is there. It does remind one a lot of German philosophy, Kant, etc. The Ding an sich, the thing in itself, we don't know. But what we do know is the representation that our sensory mechanism creates of the information that comes to us. Of course, even that way of putting it presupposes something that's out there. But we can't do anything else. We're doomed to that assumption. So rupa is the category of all those images that present themselves to your senses through the five physical senses and through the mind as a sense. Memory, for instance. You can remember the table in your family kitchen. You can remember it so clearly sometimes. You can almost feel the texture of it. Well, the mind is remembering that, is presenting you with an image. And, you know, we know so well that memory is not a window looking at a past event. It's not a direct vision of the past. It's a recreation in the present of an interpretation of the past. But the image itself, the actual presentation to consciousness, is rupa. So that's the objective part of our experience, the most objective part of our experience. Right now, we all have a perception of that appears to relate to what's out there. We've got an image of a room, people, and so forth, and that's all built up of the raw material of rupa. Rupa impacts upon us to a greater or lesser extent, or to more or less immediately. So if I stick a pin in my arm, there will be an immediate sensation of pain. That's Vedana. Vedana is a hedonic sensation. We usually translate it as feeling. But feeling in English is so vague and ambiguous and elastic, stretching everything from mere sensation through to emotion. But here is something very precise. Every rupa, every sensation, every representation gives rise to some degree of stimulation, hedonic stimulation, stimulation in terms of pleasure or pain, or gradations thereof, sometimes so minimal, one way or the other, you have to call it neutral. You don't really feel anything at all. Which, of course, gives rise to that's the experience of boredom. There's just nothing really happening, no strong sensation moving you one way or the other. So every sensation, every rupa, every representation to our senses gives rise to some degree of Vedana, some degree of hedonic stimulation, some degree of pleasure, pain, something in the middle. Some of the Vedana is very immediate. The body is a very immediate transmitter of sensation. Punch, and you feel the pain. Stroke, you feel the pleasure. Not always, but often. And so on. It gets much more complex when, for instance, sight is concerned, because sight is so much more articulated, involves so much more of what we'll be looking at next, which is samnya, so much more to do with mental interpretation. But nonetheless, every situation that presents itself to us has its own vedana quality, its own hedonic quality. It's quite important in trying to develop mindfulness. A very important learning is to keep track of the vedana, both on the level of physical sensation, but also on the level of mental sensation, because vedana can be mental as well, in the sense of happiness and sadness or pain, sorrow. And it's really important to keep track of that, because usually we don't keep track of it and it drives us. We instinctively try to move towards the pleasure, pretty sensible you might say, and to avoid the pain and to bring about stimulation when there's no stimulation, turn the volume up as it were. And very often we don't really know why we're doing things, we're simply driven by the semi-conscious background of vedana. So it's a really important area of our experience to make more conscious. So, sensation, the representations, which then are hedonically tinged, whether in a complex or a simple way. But we have to make sense of it all. Simply for survival purposes, we need to make sense of the flood of experience that comes upon us. Buddhist psychologist, Abhidhammist, the 6th century, Asanga, talks about the mind being hungry for experience. The mind eats experience. It longs for experience. And it not only longs for experience, it hungers to understand that experience, to categorize it, to make it manageable, to fit it into boxes. This is samnya. It's the filing cabinet of the mind. It's the function of the mind that breaks up the undifferentiated flow of experience, which is pouring in upon us all the time. And it breaks it up into manageable, intelligible generalities. Room, wall, ceiling, people. Of course, actually, every single moment of experience is utterly unique and unclassifiable. But we can't handle that. Anybody remember, anybody read Borges? There's a wonderful story by Borges in Labyrinths, an Argentinian, was sometimes called science fiction writer, but it completely misses the point. But he has a story about Funes the Memorious, who is a gaucho, who falls off his horse and hits his head. So he cannot forget anything. So all memories are immediately present to him. And so he can remember, you know, each vein on a leaf, on a tree that he passed 7 years ago. It's all eternally present to him. Of course, poor guy can't do anything, because he's completely flooded with impression. We can't live like that, and anybody who's taken certain psychedelics will know what that's like, trying to cross a road when you've taken LSD. It's a real adventure. And I will stop talking about drugs. It was a long time ago, a very long time ago, and I didn't get on very well with them. Anyway, I never crossed the road in the end. What those sort of drugs do is they undo the sort of mechanism that organises, they undo samnya. Of course, it's still going on. But you just can't make sense of it all. I remember a famous moment listening to Jimi Hendrix, when the only sense I could make of the situation was that I was a valve in an amplifier. In a sense, it's absolutely true, but let's not go there. But all the time, we have to try to break up this undifferentiated flow of experience, label it in these generalities, which are concepts and words, relate them to each other so that we can come to some sort of intelligent orientation towards what's going on. You know, if I lost my orientation in relation to you, God help you all. I just ramble. Well, you might think that's what's happening. We're constantly trying to manage experience by organising it and labelling it, fitting it into a narrative, fitting it into the coordinates of space and time, fitting it into the categories of experience that enable us to get breakfast, go to the Buddhist centre, and sit and gain enlightenment, ultimately. They also enable us to build atom bombs and blow each other up and ruin the environment, and so on, and make each other's lives a misery, let alone our own. But this capacity to organise our experience is very highly developed in human beings. All organisms do it to some extent. I can't remember what it was like to be an amoeba, but I imagine that amoeba has some degree of, it must do. It responds to light, it responds to various stimuli, and so on. It knows when to split. So even a simple single-celled organism has some sort of rudimentary perceptual mechanism, which includes not merely the gathering of data, but the assembling of data, the assessing of data. And I won't talk about sheep again till tomorrow. I'll leave it till tomorrow. I'll hold off sheep for another day. But every animal has its means of categorising. In human beings, we have this ability to organise our experience through language and through the conceptual structures that underlie language, which marks a huge evolutionary leap. And it's what enables us to lead such sophisticated lives and ruin the world we live in and so on. And also to create great art and to find the way out of the mess that we've created. Our human capacity to manipulate, organise, becomes extremely sophisticated. We can use abstract ideas, not just immediately related to the situation itself. We can step back from it. We can talk about goodness. We can talk about beauty. We can talk about evil. We can generalise to a very high degree, which greatly increases our range of opportunity and capacity. Something else about Samyā that I'll come back to in a while, because really it's Samyā that is the issue. Samyā is where we really have to work, but I'll come back to that in a while. Samskāra is relatively simple to understand, although it's, of course, very powerful and complex and often not easy to discern exactly what volition is going on. Samskara is the volitional activity functioning through the body, the body's desires, through speech, through what we express in our words. Every word we use comes out of desire. I'm not using desire here in a pejorative sense at all. I'm using it in a neutral sense, from the most banal or base to the most exalted. Bring me my arrows of desire. But every action we take is underlain by desire. everything we do is motivated, has within it a volition, however rudimentary our awareness of that. And of course that's another area where we need to increase our awareness of what's going on. But in a sense it's quite easy to understand. We're all the time wanting, all the time wishing. And very important to keep track of that on all sorts of levels, from the most base to the most exalted, the most humdrum. You notice your mind just wanting, 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 driving you into the future, shaping you at the direction of your life. And samskara is sometimes defined as the shaping factor. You know, in the 12 nidanas, the pictures around the outside of the wheel of life, that the samskara is represented by a potter with a wheel on which a pot is being formed. So samskara is the desire that shapes our future. Our wishes shape our future. It's the door of karma. Karma is another word for samskara, really. Then, of course, there's vijnana, which is our major topic. Vijnana in this schema is defined, as I mentioned yesterday, as momentary. So vijnana is arising again and again, from moment to moment. I think that that in the Abhidhamma, you know, like the scholastics like to classify things so much in Christian scholasticism, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? The Buddhist equivalent of that was how many moments, how long is a moment of consciousness? Well, you might be fascinated to know it's 1/16th of a finger snap. Whatever on earth that means. And how anybody worked it out, I don't know. But the samnya mind delights in this sort of classification, and some of us earn a living that way. Whether it's a good one or not, I leave to you to choose. But yes, the early teachings defined vijnana, consciousness, as momentary. Actually, I think this is simply a concession to the objectified form of speech. Really, space and time cannot be applied to consciousness. It's inaccessible to them because they are modalities of consciousness, if you like. They enter with samnya. But nonetheless, it's probably better to think of vijnana as momentary than to think of it as unitary or static. Sometimes when we talk about consciousness, we seem to be talking about a single thing, you know, a big box, which is always the same, into which things pass, through. Or like a theatre, you know, in which all the other scanders come along and do their act and then go off stage. But the set or the stage itself remains the same. So it's probably better for us to think, insofar as thinking always involves space and time, probably better for us to think of it as momentary than to think of it as not momentary. But really, this is actually the over-application of a category of thought to something to which it cannot apply. Consciousness is actually inaccessible to time. Think about it. Well, you won't be able to. So it's thought of as momentary, so you don't think of it as something static. That's better, to think of it as momentary and ever-changing than to think of it as something static. It's also treated as arising in relation to its object, its rupa, the particular form of rupa. So you get eye consciousness, which arises in relation to a visual image, a visual representation. Ear consciousness, which arises in relation to an auditory image, and so on. Mind consciousness that assembles all the others into a complex whole, and that also organises memory, imagination, and so on. So consciousness is dealt in the Abhidhamma, which is the early scholastic psychological system. It's treated as momentary and as related to its object. It operates through the door, it said, of a particular sense. So the I consciousness operates through the door of the I, and its object is visual rupa, the image that presents itself. So, according to the early presentation, all these five skandhas are impermanent. That's the chief point. You cannot find within the range of your experience, within what is experienceable, or what is experiencing, you cannot find anything static. That's the point of this particular teaching, that everything from the Buddhist point of view is impermanent. If you start to analyse all these different elements as they arise moment by moment, you will not find anything that is stable. That's the essence of this particular teaching. But I'm not going to look at it so much from that point of view. What I want to look at here is how interpretation deals with the other skandhas. Because it's the way that interpretation deals with the other categories that is the problem, and that we need to change our understanding of. So I've already talked about samnya as the organising faculty, the faculty of intelligence, not to put too fine a point upon it, the faculty that takes data, arranges it, organises it, places it in relation to other data, call it that, and forms a complete picture. Samnya not only does that on the microcosmic scale, it does it on the macrocosmic scale. It organises the underlying situation itself in terms of something out there really existing independent of the perceptual moment, and something in here that is really existing independent of the perceptual moment. It interprets our experience in terms of it belonging to an external world that is entirely objective to us. It's a pretty sensible sort of way of thinking, actually, because if you don't think that, you don't know what happens when you turn your back, if you see what I mean. Do you get what I mean? You're all looking a bit blank. But if you don't assume an external world that is somehow independent of your perception of it, life gets pretty weird, believe me. Because, yes, you turn your back and you don't know. You don't know what's there. But we automatically fit our experience into a stable environment. This is a presupposition of consciousness. Again, for the Kantians amongst you, this is the transcendental unity of apperception. This is the transcendental category which we impose upon our experience. It makes experience possible. But it is actually an interpretive category. It doesn't really exist, if you see what I mean. You cannot substantiate it. It's necessary. It's an as-if. It's as if we're saying, let's live on the basis that the external world remains objective, objectively existent, whether we're perceiving it or not. And that's okay. I think as long as one maintains it as an as-if, as a reasonable way of handling experience. The problem comes when you fix it, when you take that for absolutely real, and you do not allow yourself that little wriggle room of recognition. It's not really quite like that. I mean, you only have to start thinking of the difference between your experience and a sheep's experience. something I reflect on quite frequently, as you know. But a sheep organises the world in quite a different way. And, you know, that what it... I said I wasn't going to do that, didn't I? But they come in somehow. They're amazing, those sheep. But the sheep has its own way of samnya-ing. It has its own way of interpreting. It makes an objective world out there, independent of its perception. It's full of dogs and farmers and grass. Fundamentally, grass. We interpret the world in a completely different way. We see a world as objective to us in quite a different way. Yes, we'll come back to that. But more significantly, for the present purposes, we also read into our experience a perceiver who stands outside the moment of perception, having that moment of perception. So, almost impossible even to catch yourself doing it. It's so much part of the structure of our experience. We read into it an I who is, or that is, independent of the perceptual situation, that is somehow static, unchanging, that is somehow self-generating. It's talked of in Abhidhamma as the author of itself. So it arises, as it were, from itself, that owns experience and that is the actor upon experience. This is the sort of implicit assumption that we make about our experience. Here is the perceptual situation. We break it up into bits that are manageable to us in terms of particular conceptual structures, and we impose upon it a larger framework of an independent I in an independent reality, each of which exists, so to speak, of itself, from its own side, is the way it's sometimes put. So the world exists from its own side, whether you're perceiving it or not. This is, you know, we can't really function unless we assume that. But the problem is that this interpretation of our world leads us into difficulties. I missed out something, that's very important. Of course, what we interpret as I is this function of consciousness. We believe that consciousness, we don't believe even, we just assume that consciousness is somebody's, mine, my consciousness. It's difficult for us to organize our experience in any other way. We have to sort of read it in that way. I mean, this is, by the way, why Kant is so important from the point of view of the introduction of Buddhism into the West, because he realized that this was something that was added to experience, not something implicit in experience. And Schopenhauer works that out much more approachably. It's the basis of modern Western philosophy from that point on. And I think it's what makes it possible for Buddhism to be thought in the modern West, my own theory. Maitreya Nagarjuna is going to write a PhD on it. So we read rupa as being an objective world. And we read vijnana as being an independent I. And as I've said, for the purposes of getting to the retreat centre, getting to the class, and paying attention to what's being said and so forth, it's pretty workable. But it's not actually real. It's not actually how things are. It's an as if. Let's think of it as if there was an independent I in an independent world interacting with each other. Even if you start to analyse it logically and philosophically, it doesn't make sense. It can't work. How can you have two independent things in relationship with each other? What's their action upon each other, etc.? Yes, it breaks down. It breaks down from time to time in two different ways, it seems to me. And this is why we're all here, because it doesn't work. If it worked, we wouldn't bother to come to a Buddhist centre. Why bother? Just go away if you don't. If it works for you, please carry on. I remember Trungpa Rinpoche saying, if you haven't started, don't. If you've started, don't stop. If it all works, well, fair enough. But you're here because you know it doesn't work. Maybe you don't quite know why it doesn't work, in what way it doesn't work. It doesn't work in many different ways, but it doesn't work in relation to the object. Negatively, you could say, you experience it not working in relation to the object because what you assume to be a permanent objective world soon shows itself not to be, and defies your attempt to fix it. But more positively, it breaks down because the objects, from time to time, refuse to be what you define them as. Our most positive and approachable experience of that is aesthetic. Aesthetic experience is when the object escapes from our narrowly conceptualized interpretation of it. When it refuses to be bounded by the structures that you impose upon it. And for a little while, something wriggles through, something shouts through at you. It can happen in quite sort of trivial ways, almost. You can suddenly find yourself sort of fascinated by an ordinary object, a lamppost or something like that. I remember a very strong sort of experience of this, looking at a bird feeder. It's a fascinating thing because birds come and they're so delightful. And you suddenly slip out of the perception of it as a bird feeder, and you become fascinated by its aesthetic quality, even something as apparently unbeautiful as a bird feeder. And of course, this is what art proper is fishing in. The artist is defying your interpretive framework. I think I talked about this on another occasion, but I went to that remarkable Miro exhibition at the Tate Modern last year, and there was a room with six huge canvases, which are broadly speaking pure white with a squiggly line down them with bits of red and blue and yellow on them. But when you look at them, you can notice your mind trying to interpret them. You can notice samnya trying to get them. I went with some Indian friends who generally know very little about modern art and have no idea, so to speak, what they're supposed to do. Thank goodness. And I was a bit embarrassed taking them around. They wanted to go, but I was a bit embarrassed because I didn't know what they were making of it. But one of them was just sitting there with his mouth open, just looking at me. He said, my mind wants to know what it is. My mind wants to know what it is. He got it. That Miro had created something that the mind could not get. So at that point, a little bit, Rupa escapes the structure of samnya, and you get a little bit of a glimpse through the window, as it were. So, the system of samnya, this rigid classification of the world in terms of a perceiver and a perceived, breaks down to small or great extent in that sort of experience, in other kinds of experience too, in moments of crisis for some strange reason. When the world doesn't work any longer, it can be a strangely beautiful. I think it's quite a strong experience with death often, isn't it? That in the moment of facing the death of a loved one, there's both all the sadness and pain of separation, and a sort of brief moment, or maybe not so brief moment, of extraordinary freedom and joy, because something has broken down. Death is the great denier of the fixity of our interpretation of life. So the fact that the interpretive framework doesn't really work breaks down objectively from time to time. From time to time, it breaks down subjectively in terms of your experience, so to speak, of yourself, so to speak. In a way, that's what I was talking about yesterday, those moments when it just isn't adequate to talk about I am experiencing. There just is awareness. There just is consciousness. Where even it may be that a framework is quite uninteresting to you. You don't even want a framework, because the experience of consciousness as vast, as unlimited, as indefinable, as neither momentary nor static, as eluding all our categories, is inherently delightful, inherently blissful, beyond ordinary pleasure and pain in the Vedana sense. It is a sense of a freedom, of liberation, that comes with that momentary or not so momentary escape from the structures that we impose upon our experience. So, what I hope I've illustrated for you is the way in which we impose upon our experience a structure that makes it manageable for us and is necessary, useful. It's not that you have to sort of stop doing it and just be a big blob, as it were, just operating within a big blob, to call it that. Not really within or without, anyway. Just blobbed. You couldn't really manage that. You can't do it for a start. It wouldn't work. You know, you're not able to do it, because the mechanism of samnya is so automatic, so much it's part of the mechanics of it. Your organism is arranged to categorize, to manage. It's built in. Even the structure of an objective self, or subjective, objective subjective self, and an objective objective world, that's built in. It's built into the perceptual mechanism. But it doesn't actually accord with reality. Reality is not definable in those terms. It does for particular purposes, in particular circumstances, for a particular period. But it won't capture reality, and it will constantly lead to moments of foundering, moments when you cannot make it work, moments which are either moments of a great suffering, because you desperately want it to work, or great joy and freedom, because you realise it doesn't have to work, or rather that even it working is contained within a much larger framework of it not working, if you see what I mean. And as Buddhists, in a way, what we're trying to do is live with both. We're trying to learn to do the five skandhas properly. We're trying to learn to really pay attention to the information that our senses present to us, to keep track of the hedonic response that we have to that, to be aware of the as-if of samnya, the as-if of interpretation, and to be conscious of the drives that arise within us and why they arise and where they're going, and to be aware that none of that actually is real. It's all a kind of approximation. Probably, in a way, the clearest illustration of what this means is to be found in scientific theorising. I came across the other day a very interesting little report, which I was going to say half understood, I think probably tenth understood, about the modelling of nuclear processes in chemical reactions. He was talking about the way in which some experimenters have discovered that you can provide a model of these chemical reactions. It's extremely difficult to do because there's so many different variables, but you can provide a workable model that will provide testable results by treating what's going on partly on the terms of classical physics, or partly on the terms of quantum theory. So you can do both because they're both as ifs. They're not really what's happening. I think that's clear to modern philosophers of science that, I read one philosopher of science described scientific theory as a sophisticated statement of ignorance. And really, our samnya is a sophisticated statement of ignorance. I don't know what the hell's going on, but think of it as a Buddhist class. And that sort of works up to a certain point. I really don't know what's going on out there, but think of it as a Dhammachari giving a talk. That'll sort of work for a bit. And I don't know what he's talking about, but let's sort of assume that it's something to do with consciousness. If we can manage that, if we can manage both the acceptance of the interpretation as a, but accept it as an as-if, we can get something of the grandeur of the situation that we're in, that the extraordinarily indefinable majesty of what it is to be aware, and what it is to be aware of something, of a world out there. And if we can escape, contextualize the framework that we impose upon our experience and recognize that it has no ultimate validity, we are released from its tyranny. Most of the time we live within the tyranny of our own interpretation. And that functions at a directly psychological level, doesn't it? People lock themselves in a prison of their own psychological interpretation and then make themselves suffer. And we can always see it happening to other people. Never to me. But this goes on a macrocosmic scale. We are imposing an interpretation on our experience, which we then think is ultimately real. And it doesn't work. And we're here because it doesn't work. And because it's broken down in one way or another for everybody here. Sometimes it's broken down in an unpleasant way. Suffering has come from it. Sometimes it's broken down in a very positive way because something, some light has leaked through the chinks in the structure that we impose. Whichever it is, it's a really important starting point. The recognition that our way of structuring our experience is only an approximation and a very inadequate one from a particular point of view for a particular end to what really is. And that there's a whole world out there. There's a whole dimension of possible experience, a whole dimension of possible consciousness that is present for us. It's contained within rupa, if you see what I mean. That possibility is there contained within rupa. But probably for most of us, it's most cogently contained within consciousness. Because at every moment, consciousness will not be defined. Consciousness will not fit into the straitjacket that we try to impose upon it. It's constantly escaping, and we're constantly scrabbling to put it back. It's constantly defying our limitation of it. Because it's not limited by it, if you see what I mean. Every moment we're aware, that awareness itself is uncontainable. So it's a bit like those comedy acts where Tommy Cooper or somebody like that is trying to get a balloon into a box which is too small for the balloon, and he's popping it down there and it pops up there, and he pops it down there and it pops up there. That's what it's like. I'm sure you know exactly what I'm we're constantly trying to get to grips with the situation that we're in. And the reality eludes our interpretation. It cannot be grasped. It's a key term in Buddhist epistemology. We interpret our experience in terms of a grasper, a grahaka, and a grasp, a grahya. Graha means to grasp or seize, even in modern Indian languages, graha. But it can't be seized. We're trying to take hold of something which is not accessible to grasping. It slips through our fingers. Well, Bhante's wonderful poem, Life is King. Hour after hour, we try to grasp the ungraspable, and so on. But life is king. What he means by life is this larger... Yeah. that will not be defined. And it's there in each moment of our consciousness. And what we're trying to do, we're trying to learn through our Buddhist practice, is to let consciousness be what it already is. It's quite important, isn't it? That it's not something we have to create. It's something that's, so to speak, already there. And that's the experience you have when you do, for a while, escape the narrow straitjacket, the tight collar. What you feel is, this has always been like this. And then you forget about it. You get very excited by that idea and go around banging other people on the head with it, thereby losing it. Talking all about it. And in talking all about it, you've lost it. But that experience, that in every moment of consciousness, consciousness first of all, so to speak, emerges completely fresh, undifferentiated, unconfined, but immediately, simultaneously with its arising, we impose the structure upon it. And then, because we don't have a sufficient consciousness of what's going on, we sort of confine ourselves within that, even though we're not confined within it. It's a paradoxical situation. So, I've confined by time, although this is, of course, going on outside time. I invite you to reflect further on that. Maybe even to reflect further on moments when the structure of the five skandhas just hasn't worked for you. When rupa ceases to be defined by the labels that you impose upon it. It's apparent to you that the world out there, if you can talk about it out there, isn't out there in the way that you think of it as out there. And simultaneously or correspondingly, that what you are is not to be limited to a notion of I. That you can be simply conscious. Well, it's not so much that you can be conscious. There can be awareness without any need for any idea of somebody being aware or even something that is the object of awareness. There's just awareness. So there are moments, I'm sure, because I don't know what you'd be doing here otherwise, when you've sensed the limitations of the structuring of our experience, the epistemological, I've got to get a big word in at some point, structuring of our experience, that the interpretation of it just won't do. And if you could find time to reflect a bit upon that and just see whether there's anything in what I'm saying. We'll go on tomorrow. I want to look a bit more at what kind of emerges when you stop doing that, or when you realise that that's not reality. What emerges? What will have emerged for everybody at some point? And how do we work with that? How do we work with what will not be contained within the framework of our normal interpretive structures?